Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we're slightly forlorn in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, that's right. It's been a week where we've said goodbye, for now at least, to two men who have worn the stripes with pride and distinction in the shape of Shane Duffy and Glenn Murray. The fact that they've gone looking for more game time is not such a surprise, but it does feel very much like a changing of the guard. However, the news of Murray and Duffy's departure was softened with the news that the much sought after Ben White has put pen to paper on a deal tying into the club until 2024. In other news, the club were delighted with how Saturday's trial event at the Amex went, with 2,500 fans enjoying being back in the stadium. Let's hope that this is the start of getting back to having the Amex full and rocky again. Joining me today as we look back on the week's events is, of course, Alan Wares. And we're delighted to welcome back renowned scribe extraordinaire Nick Trepanic and, of course, Andy Bass. Good evening, gents. How are we?
Hello,
good afternoon, or whatever good time thanks. You're listening to this.
How are you, AD? That chin fluff is getting ever more exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm going for Platts.
You're going for Platts?
David Platts.
Oh, it's Nancy Platts.
David Platts.
Nancy Platts, that's it. No. Well, the
week's been good, mate. I mean, it was interesting, and I know we'll touch on this, as you said in the intro, that it was good to get back to the Amex. Point of order, saying that no one warned me just how cold it was going to be up at the top of the West Stand, up on your own. No one told us that. I know it's August and I know it was a chilly day, but dear God, I kind of foresaw it and took an extra jumper, but I think I need another three anyway.
I did warn you it was going to be cold. I mean, I was there in the middle.
Well, when did I ever listen to you?
Well, this is very true. Very, very true. But yeah, I mean, I was freezing up there in the lockdown games. It was absolutely drastic on some days. But yeah, I mean, it was great. Now, Nick, you obviously, you didn't make it along on Saturday. So we'll start with you, Andy. How was it for you? The stadium was pretty well organised, wasn't it?
I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was a tremendous success. I think they proved that they could easily hold an event with 2,500 people in there. I just think there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't do that. I felt that the level of attendance that they'd set for that stand, the sort of occupation levels, was just about right. You didn't feel crowded or, you know, overly busy. At any time, even on the concourses, people were still sort of keeping their distance, like in their own little groups of people that they were going with. So their own little bubbles. That was quite good. And the seating, you basically got more or less eight seats to yourself. I mean, it was very, very spacious.
It's like being at Reading.
Yeah.
Get that one early, Nick. Get it in early.
So, from an organisational standpoint, I thought it was excellent. It was no bother on, because there was only 2,500. I got the train, and there wasn't very many people on the train. Everybody was wearing masks.
That was one of the things, Andy. I think people were kind of expecting the stadium to be well organised, and people were generally very respectful. Like you said, people were wearing masks, and people were keeping their distance and stuff. But for me, the major issue and one of the issues that we've been reading about in dispatches ever since was the transport issues. Now, the trains were running. They were fine. The train from Brighton to Falmouth was fine.
It was just a regular service, wasn't it?
Yeah, but obviously my journey was slightly different to yours, Andy. It was exactly the same as ours, where we both got on the train at East Worthing. For some reason, no direct trains to Brighton at the moment, but we'll worry about that another day. But the train we got on from Hove to Brighton was absolutely jam-packed. There was people not wearing masks. And this is what it's going to be like as we start to ramp up the numbers allowed into the stadium, the trains are going to get fuller. And this is where the breeding ground of the virus could possibly be, right?
Well, yeah, obviously, I mean, I only took the train from Brighton to Falmer, so I did hear that the West Coast line was particularly busy. And that is a problem, but without being cruel about it, it's not really the club's problem.
In terms of,
if for instance we did go to 10,000, I would probably consider even just walking to the Amex from where I live. I could get there in just over an hour. I could probably do with the exercise.
But the thing is, Andy, if you're
use the new cycle lanes.
Well, there is that, if they're going to still exist. Andy, if the thing is for you, I mean, Brighton Station is a family station. It's pretty much door to door, and you're masked up. Now, I appreciate the point you're making here is that, you know, is everyone going to be masked up? As long as you are, then do you feel that level of safety? Or is it? Do you sort of feel that a level of disappointment, I guess, when you see others aren't wearing masks, that you think, well, hang on, you're not playing the game here. You're not doing as us. It's not as though it's about whether it's about being fair or not. Hanging in like this, now I'm not wearing this, and it's not fair. But, you know, I think this is one of those things, is it not, that we either all do it or we don't do it at all?
Well, to be honest, my brief experience of going on very sparsely populated trains since lockdown began, the trains I've been on, everyone has been wearing masks, apart from some children getting on at Lewis, who sort of went through the carriages, but most people did. But I haven't been on any busy trains. I mean,
sure.
I mean, that's been a deliberate thing on my part.
But you said going forward, with a greater crowd, that you might actually have to reconsider this. I mean, you know,
I would just go earlier. I mean, if they're going to, I seriously think they should consider, you know, changing the licensing arrangement so you can have a drink in your seat before the game. If they're going to open the ground up at 1 o'clock. And you can go and sit in your seat with a beer, then, you know, that would be a game changer. You would just get there earlier. You would go on a quieter train. And this is for like crowds of around about, you know, 7,500, 10,000.
And with that, the club would make more money because people are getting there earlier and spending more money, right?
Yeah. So, you know, but to be honest, it's, you know, I'm in a fortunate position where, you know, walking to the stadium wouldn't be a massive inconvenience anyway. So, So, you know, I unfortunately realise that is not open to, you know, most people that attend the Amex. But, you know, if I decided to walk, then that frees up a spot on the train for someone who can't.
Because we had this similar experience. Like I say, I mean, me and Aidy got the same train from East Worthing and then met you at Brighton Station. And we could see, it's almost you could tell those who were going to football and those who weren't. Because like you say, as a general rule, there was a lot of people who were not wearing masks. For whatever reason, you know, let's not go down that particular route as to why that might be. I think probably what's going to happen moving forward, and here we are at the beginning of September, the game itself was at the end of August. As time goes by and it gets colder and colder, there'll be fewer people going into town anyway, I think. And, you know, so the proportion, assuming that we can get, let's say, the 2,500 ramp up, the 5,000, the 10,000, wherever it is we're going to get to next, the greater proportion will be those who are going to football. And therefore, if they've been asked to wear a mask, you know, we'd like to think they'll get into that culture of doing so. In other words, just being mindful of other people around you. But one thing that really does spring to mind here, and it is a separate issue, I do apologise, is that Brighton have led the way in this. We've been asked to hold this ramp-up event. And we've been asked to see how it goes. And I think all of us knew that it was highly probable that so long as we complied with what was asked, it was going to be okay. There's no problem with that. The real issue is going to be 2 weeks after the event, how many people have caught COVID on the back of it. But the point is that other clubs are going to be looking at this, and not just in the football world, not in the Premier League world, probably across Europe. And there might be a Premier League missive that comes on that says no games will be played behind closed doors until X date. At which point, Brighton has the right to actually come out and say, well, hang on a minute, we've proved that we can at the very least do a 2,500 game. And we can probably do more if we were asked nicely, if you have that same spread across the stadium, even to 4,000 or 5,000. So I feel that there's that we're so far ahead of the curve here that we could actually come up with against other clubs here.
Can you imagine that the league would allow Albion the advantage of having a crowd of some sort in the stadium if others weren't? Wouldn't it have to happen across the whole of the Premier League at once? Because I just watched it on telly later, and I have to say that, you know, the difference between even 2,500 real fans in the stadium and silence or piped crowd was fantastic. I mean, it was. Because by definition you've got 2,500 of the you know, the keenest, the most enthusiastic fans. Because they're people with you know, points, they're season ticket holders. But you know, it is obviously different. Visually it's different, just having some human beings reacting, you know, there's on the far side of the touchline. So, you know, I think that I doubt if we'd be allowed to do it if no one else was.
The atmosphere becomes a living, breathing thing, doesn't it?
Absolutely. He's just asked me this, but the point, and in talking to the Premier League on a semi-regular basis or a half-regular basis, is that I think that the attitude would be, and the Premier League themselves have actually identified those clubs who would be in a more advantageous position to offer this versus those who are actually, frankly, going to struggle. But my point would be, is in that case, whether you're a Premier League club, get your house in order, get your procedures in order, and you can do this. Now, it might end up being that, you know, we could actually ultimately offer 30%, whereas Selhurst might only be able to offer 15%. You know, Manchester United might only be offered, and the percentages will be variable. But for us to have to wait until the final, the 20th club, finally gets their house in order, I think is actually going to set, you know, the others at a certain disadvantage, because what you've then got is clubs dragging their feet. So I think that there's somewhere in between what I'm saying originally and what you're suggesting there, Nick. I think there will be a happy compromise, but the fact that we're in the lead with this leads me to believe, well, if we can do it, surely so can I.
Al, on the other side of that is obviously you've also got the problem areas. You've got the places like Leicester and Manchester.
No, I get that totally.
Where the pandemic is more lively, for want of a better phrase, there's more cases there at the moment than there are particularly in our area. It's weird. Let's face it, we haven't got the answers to it, so we're going to leave it there for now. Andy.
Yeah, a couple more points. On the first point, it has to be league-wide. It will be a league-wide decision that, you know, all the clubs will be allowed to welcome whichever is a practicable number of fans. That's the only way you can do it. It's one in, all in, or one out, all out. That's the only fair way to do it. Different grounds will be able to do different levels. But what Nick mentioned was that the atmosphere of the game was excellent.
Yeah.
There's only 2,500 people there. The football was... I suppose we could get on to talking about the football.
That's what I was leading on to. Yeah.
Okay, but the atmosphere was really good, and it was great. And the thing is, it is possible, but the league will have to take into account the advice from the government. We're only going to be allowed to do this when it is officially sanctioned. So it's out of football's hands. It's not really in the hands of football. So when it is deemed safe to do it. If it's not deemed safe to do it in October, it won't happen in October. We'll have to wait.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, let's have a look at a little bit of the game as well. I mean, it's not easy to read too much into a friendly, is it? But I mean, it's
24 substitutions, wasn't it?
It was more than that, actually. Because we have three goalkeepers, so it was.
We did, yes.
But I mean, the starting lineup though had a defence of White, Webster, Dunk, Veltman, and March, which is pretty close to what you'd expect to start the first game proper, wouldn't you think?
Well, it depends if Potter. Because the number of people said that Potter wants to go five at the back or three at the back depends on how you view it. The number of people have said that and have said it for so long. Don't forget his tactics are so flexible that he can go to a four without really trying. Now, admittedly, he changed his personnel when he went to a four during the same game, so he can actually play both ways. But that seeks to presume, like I say, that every game he's going to start with a five at the back, and that is his preference. And at the moment, we still don't know that because that still hasn't been his preference yet. We haven't seen it. We've seen him play five at the back, but not always starting that way.
But it does suit his current personnel, doesn't it? We've got an overabundance of central defenders, so it makes sense to play in a system that uses as many of them as possible. We haven't got an orthodox left back that he seems to have any faith in, so it makes sense to play Solly March as a wing back, and I would think that's probably Tarik Lamptey's greatest strength as well, even though he was a substitute. Mm. I mean, I was particularly pleased to see Alzate and Bissouma in the centre midfield. I mean, that would be my ideal two anyway, if he's playing, you know, two in midfield, if he's going 4-2-3-1 or whatever.
Is that ahead of Stevens and Proper?
Yes.
Yeah.
So where does Lallana fit into your thinking then?
It's where he fits into Graham Potter's thinking that matters. Yes. Possibly a little bit further forward. Just slightly ahead of those two, probably.
So we did have that as well. I mean, basically, I mean, Lallana was he was tending to drop quite deep in this game, but we saw flashes of what he could do. Again, it's a friendly, so it was kind of like half-paced to a certain degree. But you know, I mean, it was a strong side. I mean, like I said, I said the defence there. But Lallana, Bissouma, Ozati in midfield, Morpay, Trossard up top. It was only really Lamptey that was missing from the starting lineup that you would think is.
What makes you think Lamptey is going to be chosen over Veltman?
He's better.
Yeah,
exactly. I think it's going to be very much horses for courses, as it has been with yeah. Potter.
Well, sorry, what do you mean by that? Come on.
Well, basically, he's always picked a side to combat the opposition and to give ourselves what Potter thinks is the best possibility of winning the games, and for some games that's going to be Veltman, for some games that's going to be Lamptey. But I mean, there's no reason you can't have them both in the same team. I mean, he did try to play Lamptey a little bit further forward as more of an
awful. Was that against Leicester, wasn't it?
No, it was. It didn't work, but it was.
It was Manchester
United or Liverpool or somebody.
Yeah, it was one of those. Yeah.
It didn't work at all.
No.
But I mean, you know, I mean, here we are. The season hasn't even started. We can't second guess what Potter's going to do because this is what he's tactically fluid and he expects the players to be so. We're going to talk a little bit more about who we want, what we're going to need a little bit later on. But the goal that Chelsea scored very early on in the game, I mean, if VAR was involved in this game, that would have been ruled out, wouldn't it? Surely.
I'm really not so sure. I've seen it. I mean, I remember watching it from my vantage point in the West Stand upper. So probably just about the highest, you know, one amongst the highest people up in the stadium. And you kind of have it in the back of your mind, and unless you see it again and again or whatever, you have it in your back of your mind that was offside. And there was nothing about that that said to me offside. I just genuinely think, and I think it was Ben White was the last defender, that I just genuinely think he lost him. I'm not convinced it was offside. There was a lot of people screaming it was. The weird thing that actually I thought more than anything is I thought I heard a whistle go because everyone just seemed to stop. The fellow who headed it across, he just sort of like hit his head and shoulders. The worst sort of like nod on I've ever seen.
He was heading at goal and completely misheaded it.
Yeah, he did completely. But yes, having not seen the replay, there was. I don't recall, let's put it this way, I don't recall thinking that was offside.
It did look very much off to me.
Well, by the time he got the ball, then yeah, but like, so that's what happens when a defender loses the forward.
I mean, in terms of the other stuff, I mean, there was quite a lot of penalty drama in this one where, there was a lot of fighting over the ball about who was going to take it. Even the first penalty that Morpay missed, there was a queue of players actually wanting to take the ball off it.
One assumes that there is a designated penalty taker, and if they haven't sorted it out between them, then and they really should, because to my mind, I think Mopay's the designated penalty taker. But when obviously, you know, if everyone else is on the pitch, and if he's not, then they have a second, a third, fourth, whatever choice it might be. So If there was any barning, I've no idea what it was about.
Well, the first one, Bissouma wanted it.
Bissouma always wants it, and Bissouma is not the dedicated. You know, the penalty taker,
and the second one, there was a queue of them basically. I mean, Gross but Connolly wanted it, McAllister wanted it.
But again, they could have sold that out. But again, previously, Gross was the designated penalty taker, so
for a time, because Murray missed a few, but it was one. But yeah, I mean, it was interesting. And the other talking point from the game itself was young Christian Walton finally being given the opportunity to challenge Matt Ryan, and he lasted 18 minutes.
Well, you say challenge him. I think that Matt Ryan is still the first choice goalkeeper. What worries me about that south area penalty area is it's becoming a goalkeeper's graveyard. You know, we've cropped three in the last 10 months.
Only one of ours.
Oh, that's all right.
Particularly sad for Walton, because I think this was the year he was going to come back and be the number two.
Yeah.
But speaking actually, not just the penalty area, but watching on the telly, was the pitch all right? It's the first game of the season, and there's threadbare patches in the North Stand goal. I mean, people have complained about the pitch in the past. It didn't look great, considering that was I think they played against Portsmouth, didn't they? You know, it didn't look like a beginning of the season pitch to me.
Oh, no, they played Portsmouth.
We were at the other end.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, we were at the other end. We were at the south stand.
Yeah, it looked fine to me.
The only thing I'd say about it is that from my bird's nest view, it looked a bit slow. I mean, the ball didn't seem to be running that particularly fast. That's the only thing I'd say. So was the grass cut as short as they do? I don't know, but, you know, okay. Certainly looked like a summer lawn.
Okay, but before we move on from this one, I know that Andy and Al, there was a couple of players that really, really caught your eye. So let's talk about those, starting with Jason Malumbi, Al.
Yeah, I just thought that he held everything together for much of the time that he was on the pitch. He looked quite at home, didn't pull up trees, but didn't look out of place either, especially when considering who he's playing against. No, very impressed. Does that mean he's going to get a chance? For me, what worries me about him is that he's got so much traffic ahead of him in order to get a place in central midfield. I mean,
so did Stephen Alzati at the beginning of last season. And
well, I think Alzati was dropped in. Don't get me wrong, but then that means that someone like and maybe we are right. Maybe the consideration is the case that Stevens and Proper have actually now dropped down the pecking order, because once upon a time they were the automatic pick. Mm. And there's a side of me that thinks that they shouldn't be discarded just yet. Which, talking of which, was what's wrong with Proper? Was he in? He wasn't even on the bench, was he?
I think he picked up a knock, but in training, but right. It wasn't.
He's supposed to have a slight groin or something, or right. Perhaps some slight interest from Ajax. Who knows?
But Andy, Nick mentioned him earlier there, and he sees him as an heir apparent to Stevens and Neil Prepper, and that was Stephen Alzati, and you were very impressed with him.
Yeah, I just go along with what Nick said. You know, for me, Batsuma and Alzati, as a sort of younger, more dynamic unit that has a bit of steel in it, I just think it just seems to offer more. Alzati, considering he's been out for absolutely ages,
I look great at home.
He looked like he hadn't been away for 5 minutes. Yeah. And they're very much the player that we were all impressed with at the beginning of last season. He looked to be exactly the same player. He didn't look diminished in any sense of the word. And I think that's extremely encouraging for the Albion and for Potter, because he's now overflowing with options. I mean, if we're talking about, you know, Stevens and Purper maybe dropping down the pecking order, well, that's just, you know, 18 months ago, unthinkable.
Sure.
That two first, but now these first choice players are now in competition with another pairing that could quite easily be the first choice, and on merit. It's good to have this competition, and I think it's going to bring the most out of all four of them.
There is one more player we do have to talk about. I mean, I did want to mention him. I can't remember if I told you I wanted to mention him. It's someone who you really didn't get to see that well, because he was only playing on my side of the pitch, and I thought that Veltman actually slotted in very, very comfortably, very, yeah, very, very, very well. I mean, you were on the east side, so he was on the opposite side of the pitch to you. There is an element of Bruno about him. He does have a flick, he does have the good positional awareness. He rarely gave it away. He could see when trouble was coming, and he knew the out ball. He had Lallana and Batsuma playing alongside him and linked up well with them. There is a temptation to say that Veltman and Lamptey will work together quite well, but I can't see it. I'm probably going to take the unpopular view here is that I would actually probably, depends on who we're playing, I'd rather see Veltman starting than Lamptey.
Okay. Well, one player that wasn't playing in this game was one which you talked about it briefly last week, Al, but let's just talk about it before we move on, and that was Aaron Moy. And I was very surprised to see him moved on so quickly.
To be honest, given the conversation we've just had, I was surprised like to see him go to like China. It was kind of an out of the blue move.
Yeah.
But in terms of the conversation we've just had, you know, how many more central midfielders do we need? And we've just bought in Lallana. It doesn't, you know, it looks like Gross is going to stick around. It looks like, you know, Purpa and Seamers are going to stick around. You've got Basuma and Alzati. And then Malumbi is, you know, depends whether we'll loan him out or whether we will retain him in the match day squad, all pressing now and all making good cases for their inclusion in the side. You know, how much game time would he have got? And I think, you know, he's obviously going to get a very nice payday out in China.
Yeah.
He did pretty well here. And so good luck to him.
Sure. Nick, apparently you had a China release clause in his contract.
Yeah.
But I mean, were you surprised to see?
I was kind of surprised. The more I think about it, the more it makes sense. You know, that squad needed thinning out, and you know, it's to some extent, it's a bit of addition by subtraction. People get more chances to play. Kind of significant thing to me is the confirmation of that vote. There's only going to be three substitutes allowed. Mm. When you had five, and when Potter was making full use of the five substitutions in every game, I think we had a bit of an advantage over some of the other clubs who were, you know, beginning to bellyache a bit about the five substitutions and saying, oh, it's only going to benefit the big clubs. Well, I think it benefited us as well because it gave everyone a bit of game time and people on the bench thought, oh, you know, I've got a better chance of playing. You know, people who aren't even getting on the bench, which is going to be the situation as we go forward, it breeds a bit of discontent, you know, even if it's with the best will in the world, you know, if more people have a chance to play, then that's good, isn't it? And you have to say that it probably makes, you know, leaves some squad places empty and just in case they want to bring some more people in.
Okay, I mean, with that in mind though, Nick, so, I mean, obviously, I mean, with the squad that we've got and the fact that money is very thin on the ground for a lot of clubs now, obviously, because of COVID, etc. Having that five subs option, it's great for blooding a young player who giving them the experience as well, isn't it?
I would have hoped we were one of the clubs that voted in favour of it, because I can see, yes, from what you say there and the fact that we are not struggling for bodies, or we certainly weren't last season. So I think that we were probably one of the few clubs in the what you might call the rest of the Premier League who would have welcomed that.
Was it a 14-6 vote?
Something like, but I don't think that the votes were the same, were they? But
no, I know it has to be 14. Yeah. When we had Paul Barber on a few weeks ago, he wasn't sure as to whether the rule was reverting to three from five, or whether it was staying, or whether it was five from nine. But whatever it was, I've got the feeling that the clubs voted for the status quo. So if it was, if it had reverted to three from five, then they voted for that. Or if it had have been five from nine, there's a good chance they'd have voted for that. So whatever the I think they were happy to vote for the status quo. At the time of him of talking to him, he didn't know which way the club was going to jump. So who knows?
Yeah. I have to say, I think that is going to be a pretty tough bench to get on next season.
Mm. Yeah.
There's going to be some good players that will be disappointed that they're not even sitting on the bench, let alone not making the first 11. This squad has sneakily got quite deep in many positions, except for one.
Well, Andy, that leads us neatly onto the second half of the show, which we'll talk about in a minute. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show is brought to you, as ever, in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and myself, Alan Wears, Andy Bass, and Nick Trepanic will be trying to work out which particular jersey Phil has sent us this week. So over to you, Nick. What do you make of this one?
First of all, I had a sort of Mexican feel, which was to do with the badge, which is a sort of looks like a, something in that big square in Mexico City. But I don't know, the colours don't look very Mexican in that they're rather restrained. The sort of coloured palette is more sort of Northern European. Garmin is the manufacturer, and I'm trying to think if I've ever even heard of them before.
Well, they're not, this is not to be confused with the sat-nav people, clearly.
No.
Otherwise, they might get lost.
I'm going sort of Holland Dutch way. So it's a Dutch third choice team for one of those teams sort of scull around in the not. Europa League.
Go on, Andy, you have a go.
Well, Andy, can you describe the shirt for us, actually, Andy?
Okay, well, it's got a main white body with a blue and white trimmed base, followed by a sort of yellow band before you hit the main white bit of the body, then some blue piping just prior to the main piping on the shoulder, which is a sort of like a yellow diamond, very much like a really bad version of the old Admiral.
Well, it is the Garmin logo, isn't it?
And my guess is going to be a Baltic.
No, Baltic, it's not. It's not a Baltic.
Okay. First and foremost, it has
like a kind of like an Algarve plant sticking out of it. That's not a clue, by the way.
But. Okay. Well, first and foremost, it doesn't look like a football shirt. It looks like a cricket shirt. It looks like an ice hockey shirt. Verilou should be the main clue here, that this is the big sponsor across the chest, but I've never heard of Verilou. I mean, right. I think the other thing about it is Nick saying about the badge, and it is a very colourful badge. It's kind of a big sort of church. It's not even a church. It's like a palace. It's a bit like as if someone squashed the Royal Pavilion and put it across the blue. I tell you what, I'm going to say something Central Asian. I know it's a bit left field, but I'm going to say something from...
It's not... I'm going to say that Nick was along the right lines, but he just didn't get the right country. And this is the 1998 to 1999 home shirt of Belgian side. Koninklijke Voetbal Club Westerler, more commonly known as Westerler. They play in the Belgium First Division B, which is the second level of football, in the Kingdom of Belgium. And their stadium is the Het Kuipje, which has a capacity of 8,035. And the Het Kuipje translates to be the small tank. The club's nickname is the Kempenen, which translates to be the roughs or the ruffians. I kid you not. Look it up.
Brilliant.
The club was formed in 1933 when two local sides, Sportkring Westerler and Westerler Sport, decided, despite their rivalry, to merge to give themselves a better chance to climb the leagues. In 1968, they made it to the third division, and over the years, they ventured into the top flight and on occasion managed to qualify for the UEFA Cup by winning the Belgian Cup in 2001. And the Europa League being runners-up in the Belgian Cup in 2011. Famous former players include, well, actually, I don't think there are any famous former Westerlo players. Maybe the link to the Albion will change that in years to come. Leandro Trossard was born in Genk, made 17 loan appearances for Westerlo in 2013-14, scoring three times and helping the Kempenen to promotion. So thanks for that, Phil. Of course, there are over 100,000 shirts on oldfootballshirts.com, some of which are mingers, some of which are things of beauty.
I think that one comes on.
I actually really like this.
There.
But let's just, while we're on Belgium, we'd be remiss of us not to talk about our links to Belgium at the moment with Mr. Bloom's other club. They're doing very well. Obviously, our South African international is now Anderlecht.
Andy. So what you're actually saying is, do we have a Belgian correspondent on the show today?
Best
we're doing actually on that is that Andy is drinking out of a Leffe glass at the moment. That's the best we can offer at the moment.
There wasn't some guy called Jose Izquierdo at a Belgian club at one point.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, and obviously Leandro.
We've got knockout from Belgium. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I mean, obviously Tony's got. Really can't remember the name of the team now.
Oh, Union Saint-Gilloise.
That's it.
Who recently signed a central defender from Portsmouth, because obviously we hadn't got room for any more central defenders at the Albion, so...
Yeah, but they have also... Sebastian Pocconoli now plays for them as well, so there's a link there as well. So, but yeah, let's move on then to the main this week, I guess, which is... Tartar for now to Glenn Murray.
Don't be sad, Ailey. Don't be sad.
Well, I mean, it was kind of inevitable. I mean, the fact that he didn't get any minutes on Saturday kind of like it was
and the writing was on the wall, possibly, but
yeah, and you know, he's always going to want, you know, Glenn is a terrific Championship striker. I mean, he's a great Premier League striker, actually, and I still think that he would have had a role to play here, and I don't think. Potter would have let him go unless Glenn had asked to.
Well, actually, Nick, what are the national scribes saying? Is there any word on sort of, you know, hit the consideration that for Glenn and for the club here?
Well, I mean, I was actually asked to do something for the Watford website actually on Glenn on the day he went, so my sort of attention on Glenn was sort of focused really, and you know, they said, you know, what are his qualities? And apart from his unique gift for being fouled, which is possibly the number one, I just said, well, you know, the difference between him and other forwards is with most forwards, when they're through on goal, you think, how's he going to miss this? And with Murray, you always expected him to score, which is a significant difference between, you know, him and almost any other forward you see. And, you know, the thing that always struck me, you know, was the intelligence, his football brain, and you know, the way he would, you know, you'd say, oh, it fell to him in the box. Well, he'd been in the right place at the right time, and that comes with experience and know-how, you know, and like Teddy Sheringham, the first couple of yards are in the head, and you know, the brain is still sharp. So I think that, you know, down at that that level where there just is a little bit more space if you know where to look for it, I think, you know, he can thrive again. And you think about one of his interventions last season, you know, that goal at West Ham, but particularly the way he set up the goal for Mopay at Southampton. You know, he'd made his move to get the flick on from the throw-in before the defenders had really woken up to what was going on. And without that little run of 2 yards, you know, before he had a chance to exhaust himself, you know, that goal wouldn't have got scored. So,
no, he had a good record at Southampton as well, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting the point you're making about when he's through on goal, that one-on-one, and you said, how is someone going to miss this? When you say that, the first thing that sprang to mind was, how long will it be before the defender catches up with him?
Well, I did mention to the guy at Watford that my favourite moment of our first season in the Premier League, when he was put clean through against Arsenal.
He went backwards.
And after running about 5 yards, he realised he had no chance of outrunning the Arsenal back four. So, yeah. Turned around and went back towards our own goal, but kept possession. Because yes. What would have happened if he kept going? Then, you know, they would have caught him up and got the ball off him. So, you know, that just the brain of the man. You know, it's,
yes. But, I mean, there was. I mean, obviously, I mean, going back to when Glenn first joined us back in 2008, I think,
something like that. Yeah,
and he was, you know, he was probably the first player that Tony Bloom actually paid for. Outright, he paid the $300,000 to Rochdale.
No, it was Dick Knight that did that. Dick Knight bought
it. Dick Knight was a chairman, but I mean, I know Tony was very much instrumental.
Oh, yeah,
but it was that his home debut against I can't remember who was it against.
Brew.
That's Brew. It, and scoring twice, two exquisite goals, great finishes, and you know he never really looked back from there. Obviously, there was the bit where. He disappeared off there, which is, I think we mentioned this earlier in the week on our social media, that it was the biggest mistake that Gus Poyet ever made.
Without a doubt.
Probably,
I'm still mystified. But you know, I think, you know, Tony had to back the manager. He's not going to force, it's not Tony's job to pick the players, but really, yeah, I think that was probably the beginning of the end for Gus, I think.
That decision
cost us.
Sure. Nick,
big time. And it's, you know, people go on about club legends and whatnot, you know, all the time, but I'm pretty sure that everyone here and pretty much everyone listening is going to agree that if you give Glenn Murray the term legend, you apply it to him, I don't think anyone's going to be disagreeing about it.
Absolutely
superb servant. The number of goals are amazing. Who knows how many he would have scored if we hadn't let him go at that particular point. He'd probably have another 40, 50 goals to his Albion name.
Sorry, Nick, you were going to say?
Yeah, no, the fact that he could go to Crystal Palace and play very well for them and still be welcomed back, you know, and he wasn't entirely sure that he would be, but I don't think that was ever in doubt, because I don't think anyone, you know, at this end of the A23 blames him for going there. I mean, he's, you know, he has money to make and, you know, needed to score some goals and probably realised that that was a place he was going to score loads with the service he got from those wingers. I was quite glad to see him go to Watford, which is a club I don't object to. I mean, if he'd had a sort of Albion career of going to Crystal Palace, Reading, Bournemouth, and God, where else could he have gone to make it any worse? Portsmouth?
Yeah.
No, Watford's awesome. Okay. It'd be interesting to see him play in that kit they've got.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, Glenn ended up with 285 appearances for us, 111 goals, 20 assists, 41 yellow cards, 4 red cards. Can anyone remember the 4 red cards before we get on to goals?
One of them was we were protecting his face in the Sheffield Wednesday game.
That was his last one, yeah.
That gave David Stockdale a chance to be a hero twice over. So
yes, it did, yes.
That was a great red card.
That was also the ultimate in taking away the limelight from you.
Yeah.
I love the way that he stayed in the tunnel.
Yep.
He didn't see
the second save, though. He does say he doesn't see the follow-up. He just saw the...
But he just cheered and just turned joyfully towards the dressing room.
Wasn't there a case someone was saying, that you're talking about the red cards, that someone was saying that he was so fed up with the game, he actually just deliberately handled or caught something or caught the ball in the area?
I don't think so. I mean, basically, I mean, there was the three others were... One, actually, we put it out on social media. We're going to talk about the goals in a minute. But it was one of the best goals he ever scored. It was actually at this game as well, where he scored an absolute belter at Tranmere. And I have absolutely no recollection of him being sent off in that game at all. But he did see red in that game. Yeah, see, that was a second yellow, to be fair. But,
okay.
But he went off. And the other one... It's a 4-0 home win against Barnet in the Carling Cup. You also, was the other one?
Can't remember. I couldn't tell you.
No, I couldn't tell you that one as well. Obviously, the hand.
Okay, well, let's put your guns ahead here, Andy, and let's ask you here. Now, I know we've got to sort of go through about sort of 7 or 8 seasons worth here, but give us your best and worst of Glenn Murray.
My best, because I have been thinking about, you know, what is my favourite Glenn Murray goal, considering there's so much to choose from. And if we're just going to go through best goal, I think my favourite is the one, he's the first goal against Norwich in the 5-0 hammering.
Classic. Where he went around the keeper.
Where he just won it off, you know, Norwich had been bigging it up all week, and then he just like bustles the ball off the keeper, goes round, and you know, nearly misses an open goal, which is even funnier. But I just loved the attitude of the entire team that day was like, you are not going to disrespect us like this, and he set the tone from that, and it was a massively important win and a real statement, and it was. And that was, for me, that was Glenn Murray. That was like his competitive spirit, his willingness to get in there, the fact that he was very strong. He was always very good at holding up the ball, but his strength was a big part of his game, as well as his football brain and his deftness with both head and feet. I absolutely love that goal. That's my second favourite, because I have to mention it, because I just think it's so exquisitely skillful, is the opener he scored against Manchester United.
Yeah.
When he just dinked it in. I mean, that's a top draw Premier League goal in anyone's book. I don't care who scored it. That just shows what a good footballer he is. Mm. As for the worst, I don't know. I think the Nadir was the Brentford away match where people got the ump with him when he didn't respond to people sort of chanting his name as he walked off the pitch or something like that. That was a little bit of a silly season moment. But really, what is the worst of Glenn Murray? The worst of Glenn Murray was that Gus Poyet, for some reason, didn't think he was good enough to play for our team.
And the worst places he went to.
Worst bit is the lost years when he was banging them in for Palace, Reading and Bournemouth.
Yeah. Okay, Nick, same question to you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely that Manchester United goal was actually in the East Upper, sort of behind the Solly March cross, and just thinking, stay on side, Glenn. And he did absolutely everything right, you know, got it ahead of his player, and then produced a finish that I still don't think that De Gea had a clue what has happened. He must have seen it several times. And, you know, just the imagination to do that as that ball came over, rather than sort of, you know, smack at it with your left foot or something. It was, you know, just an amazing second of invention. And, you know, another example of how quickly his brain works. I think, although I wasn't there, but I've seen it, you know, on video, that amazing performance of his at Wickham, you know, including, you know, almost a in diving header, really, for a fairly undynamic player at sometimes. But also, I think, as important goals go, his opener in the 3-0 win at West Ham for our first away win in the Premier League. Should and no right to get it in that sort of thicket of players, but, you know, just a goal scorer's goal, really. Got it the right part of his head to it, just guided it out of Joe Hart's way. And that really, you know, that you could see the confidence grow in the team from that moment on, really. And it was great. Was there any worst moments? He was one of many players who couldn't score a penalty to save their lives in that in the promotion season, you know, when Gus used to hide behind the dugout and not watch. I thought he got over that, because he had this, he seemed to really discover the art of scoring penalties by putting them just under the crossbar. And of course, that's always going to go wrong. And he, in the shootout against Millwall,
I did but laugh luckily, this that week, didn't count. Nick, when I was watching what they were announcing the transfer on the BBC News this week, and they used him the footage of him missing that penalty at Millwall in their showreel. But it was,
you knew he was going to miss that.
Well, yeah. The one person you can expect to tuck it away is the.
It's a very risky penalty shootout.
Going high is a very, very risky option, isn't it? I mean, it looks great when it works, but you're no one's ever going to hit the ball under the ground from under the goal from a penalty, but you do risk hitting it over. On a personal level as well, he came to the book signing of Brighton Up and must have put an extra couple of hundred on the gate there.
Brilliant.
Oh, well, fantastic. Well, we've asked the question about your favourite mother moments over our social media, on our Twitter and on our Facebook page. So I'm just going to go through a couple of these here. Well, I'm going to have to paraphrase a couple of them, because his words we're not allowed to use on the radio, strangely. Yeah. But Simon Maskell, his goal against QPR, absolute scenes, he says. Nicolo Antoinette, when he scored with his man sausage.
Can I just say, actually, of all people that mentioned that particular goal where he scored with his lower midriff, it's mostly women who have pointed that out. Carry on.
Strangely, yeah. Ash Bradder's absolute worldie at Tranmere, the game where he got sent off. Birmingham away, that was the celebrations when celebrations.
The fastest he ran in his entire Albion career.
Fastest and furthest.
If someone could actually time that run against the one that upset so many people in that game against Leeds and Fabian Delph all those years ago,
that would be great.
He was injured in that game.
But the thing is, Andy, it was actually part of, and you mentioned that the whole Brentford thing, it was part of the time when, you know, his missus hadn't settled down here, supposedly. There was this going on, there was that going on, and there was a little bit of a love-hate relationship with Dean, under whether it was under Mickey or whether it was under Mickey had gone by then, whether it was under Russell, whether it was under whoever it was. There was a bit of a love-hate thing going on. And he wasn't the most popular person until that final season out with Dean, when he scored 22 goals and got us up and led the line brilliantly.
Yeah. We've got one here from Jared Evans, a regular to this parish. Yeah. He says, bizarrely, one of the moments I most remember Glenn for is scoring the third for Palace at the Amex. We've been giving him so much stick all game, and it was his chance to rub our faces, and he didn't, and he stayed massively dignified.
Well, he did the same when he scored for Brighton against Palace, actually, for his 100th goal or something.
Yeah, and when he scored against us for Reading as well.
It's just scoring against us when he plays against us.
But there's a lot of people going for Birmingham. Matt Wilkin, again, a member of this parish. Yeah. Can't remember the opposition at the Amex, but we were holding on for a win and giving the ball away time after time. We bring Glenn on, who immediately places himself in front of the defender to get a shove in the back, wins the free kick and run the clock down to see us home. Absolute classic.
Well, actually, along the same lines, AD, I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago, it was in the FA Cup replay at West Brom. We couldn't score for love nor money. Balogun, Christ alone knows what he was doing on the post. And who, I can't remember who it was, he got a retrospective red card. I think it was Andoni, wasn't it? Got a retrospective red card. But it took Glenn to come on and show the kids how to do it. You know, it was the old man that had to come on and save the day with a couple of late goals. So, you know, again, it's that kind of thing that that's the sort of thing we're remembering for. It's not the glory. It's not the knockout like wizardry. It's not the Peter Ward pace. It's the man who is there at the right time, at the right moment, doing the right thing. That's what
having a goal celebration.
And also, I just think, you know, the way he's conducted himself throughout his career at the Albion and away from the Albion, it's just been absolutely brilliant. I think he's really endeared himself. I think when he moved away to play, he still lived here and people saw him around town and he was fine. I had the pleasure of meeting him at the sponsors' dinner one time, and what a lovely bloke.
Absolutely.
But Shane Duffy, again, I said at the top of the show, another player that wore the stripes with pride and distinction. 130 appearances, 8 goals, 5 assists, 19 yellows, 1 red. Can you remember the red?
Yep, Palace.
Yeah.
It wasn't even that much of a headbutt. If you're going to headbutt someone, really do it properly.
Oh, Christ. If it was going to headbutt him, he'd have known about it, or you'd have not known about it. It would have woken up the following week. But yeah, totally stupid one.
But Shane's got the move to his childhood club, which is always a boy's own story, I guess, for guys and girls. But he's a guy that I'm surprised that we have let go. But obviously,
why are you surprised?
Didn't fit.
Why are you surprised?
I don't know, because obviously, he just didn't fit in with the Potter ball style. Although, you know, every time he has come in, he's never let us down. I learned the phrase, I think off you, Al, of gestalt entity that is Duncan Duffy. It's that those two together were just the first names on the team sheet under Chris Hughton, and they were just an absolute rock, and you can always, eight goals is a decent return for a defender. Possibly should have got more, to be honest. I mean, actually, he scored for Ireland in the injury time this week, didn't he?
But yeah. Nick, surely this is a move that makes sense for everyone here, doesn't it?
It does. Yes, it does. I mean, it's obviously a good move for him going to Celtic. If he wants to captain Ireland, you know, in the Euros, then he needs to be playing every week. I suppose the idea of breaking up Duncan Duffy is if you have a central defender who can play out with the ball, then the ball doesn't come back so quickly and you don't need that the two immovable objects at the back, you know, to repel all boarders, because in theory we have the ball further forward and further away from our goal. I mean, that said, it's a risk, because I mean, notice when Norwich were starting to exert pressure, you put Duffy on towards the end of that game, Linda, last season, and in fact it was a cross, you know, that it was the man that Byrne was marking that nearly headed an equaliser, and I think we might be in a different place if that ball had gone in. So, I mean, it's clear that that Potter realised that, you know, that he was still an asset. The trouble is, of course, you know, you can't have everybody. You can't have a squad of 40 players and be able to use them for 2 seconds at a time, or, you know, a couple of plays. We're not we don't have special teams in British football.
No.
Okay. So, I mean, you mentioned there, but I mean, obviously, I mean, Shane goes like that. Massive Celtic fan all his life. Him and his family, absolutely delighted. And we wish him the best of luck.
So I think this is a player who certainly is, for all the faults and for all the sort of like the jocular stuff, that certainly the things that have gone on off pitch, he certainly leaves us, I think, in credit. You know, we pay $4 million for him. Celtic are coughing up $2 million for a year's worth of services. Maybe they'll buy him at the end of it. We don't know, but you know, he certainly leaves us with our thanks, and certainly, like I say, I think in the plus
Absolutely.
Column.
Well, that moves us on to Ben White signing a new deal this week. There's been lots of white noise about him. How good is he, and how good can he be, Nick?
How good can he be? Well, he has yet to kick a ball in the Premier League, so I don't think anybody knows. I mean, Leeds seemed fairly convinced, if you believe all the stories about Liverpool and Chelsea looking at him, then obviously they would seem fairly convinced. I'm not sure I do believe. I'm sure they've watched him, but I don't believe that anyone's made anything approaching a bid. So I'm sure they'd like to see how he gets on this season. Interestingly, he said that Duffy leaving was one of the elements that convinced him to sign the new contract, which could make sure that we have ownership of a very, very good player for a long time. I mean, Gareth Southgate has talked about him possibly getting a look before the European Championships, but
Dunkey said in a recent interview that perhaps Ben and Adam Webster are ahead of him in the England queue now.
Adam Webster, interesting point of view. I mean, White fits the sort of profile that Southgate likes in many ways. As I say, you know, that let's see how he does in the Premier League. He'll be playing with better players than he was last season, but he'll be playing against better players than he was last season. So it's too early to tell. But I'm glad we have the option of having his services.
Andy?
I'm looking forward to seeing what all the fuss is about. I quite liked him in that brief cameo he had against Colchester in the Carabao Cup a couple of years ago. He did look very good in that game. I thought he did, you know, in the first glance on Saturday against Chelsea, the Werner goal aside, I thought he looked very assured and confident. Clearly good at football in terms of like bringing it out and stuff. I think it's an exciting prospect to have Webster, Dunk and White at the back and seeing what Graham Potter makes of it, quite frankly. I think it's very exciting.
All right, Andy, well, that's interesting stuff there, mate. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for, so we'll have to look at who's coming in for Glenn next week and who we'd like to see and what style of play that's going to be. But for now, thank you, of course, to Alan Wes. Thank you to Andy Bass. Thank you to Nick Trepanic. I've been Andy Packham. This has been the Albion Roar in association of oldfootballshirts.com podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again.
It was the theme she had on the scheme he had, told in a foreign land, to take life on earth to the second birth, and the man was in command. You can help them. You can never. from a bad